eyes and wait a while. Maybe when he opened them, he'd discover he'd passed out before even getting on the plane. Maybe if he took deep breaths and rested, when he next lifted his head, there would be green grass beneath him and concerned faces, Harriet's among them, bent over him. It was just cool enough to make him a tiny bit uncomfortable. At some point, nestled in a soft, slightly elastic nest of cloud stuff, he reached out absently, found the corner of a blanket, drew a thick quilt of churning white smoke across his body, and slept. 6. There was one good moment just as he woke when he didn't remember any of it. He gazed into a bright, clean sky, and he felt that the world was a kind place. His thoughts turned naturally to Harriet, as they often did when he first awoke. Aubrey liked to imagine rolling over and finding her beside him. He liked to imagine her bare back, the sharp, clean lines of her shoulder blades and spine. It was his favorite morning thought. He rolled over and looked out across barren cloud. The shock of it jolted through him, knocked the lazy, rested, in no rush to get up feeling right out of him. He sat up and found he was in a large bed, a four-poster shaped out of white cotton. Blankets of creamy smoke had been pushed down around his waist. Pillows of vanilla custard were mounded beneath his head. His coat rack kept a lonely watch a few feet away, helmet and harness dangling where he'd left them. It was close to dusk now. The red coal of the sun stood off to the west, almost level with him. His shadow stretched to the far edge of the cloud island. The shadow of the bed was harder to see, a shadow cast by a ghost. He did not give the bed much thought, not then. It was like the coat rack, just on a larger scale, and at the moment he was still too drowsy to manage much in the way of amazement. He slipped from under the blankets and crossed to the trailing edge of the island, keeping only about 4 feet between himself and the drop. The country below was drenched in crimson glare. The green fields were shading to black. He did not see the runway, did not recognize any of what was below him. How fast was the cloud moving? Fast enough to have left the headquarters of Cloud Nine Skydiving Adventures far behind. He was surprised, and also surprised at his surprise. Aubrey studied the darkening map of Ohio below. Or at least he assumed it was still Ohio. He saw forest, he saw ruddy rectangles of sun-roasted earth. He saw aluminum roofs flashing in the dying furnace light of the day. He spotted the broad, dark stroke of a state highway almost directly below, but who knew which one it might be? He thought he was still being carried north and east, at least based on where the sun was going down. What was ahead? Canton? He might have skirted by Canton while he dozed. He couldn't even begin to estimate how fast the cloud was moving, not without some way to keep time. It unnerved him, looking over the edge of the cloud. With the help of a therapist, Dr. Wan, he'd made good progress, had come to feel he was well past his fear of heights, one of a dozen neurotic anxieties she'd been working on with him. At the end of their sessions, she would push open her office window and they'd both stick their heads out to peer at the sidewalk 6 stories below. For a long time, he could not look without being nearly overcome by vertigo, but eventually he got to the point where he could nonchalantly lean on the sill and whistle Louis Armstrong numbers into empty space. Dr. Wan was a big believer in testing the anxiety, in steadily diminishing its power by confronting it. But a sixth-floor office was one thing, and a platform of smoke located almost 2 miles above the ground was another. He wondered what Dr. Wan would have made of his plan to attempt skydiving. He hadn't told her because he suspected she would be skeptical of his ability to do it, and he didn't want skepticism. Besides, if he told her he was going to jump out of a plane, she would have asked why, and he would have had to say something about Harriet. And for the purposes of therapy, he was over his Harriet fantasies. He turned and considered his four-poster bed of cloud, his coat rack, and his likely fate. It did him no good to disbelieve his situation, to argue with his circumstances. He was here, and he accepted he would go on being here, no matter how hard he tried to talk himself into denying the reality around him. And that was fine, and that was right. Aubrey was a musician, not a physicist or a journalist. He didn't know if he believed in ghosts, but he liked the idea of them. He had enthusiastically participated in a séance with June and Harriet once, holding Harriet's hand for half an hour. He was pretty sure Stonehenge was a landing pad for aliens. It wasn't in Aubrey's nature to ruthlessly interrogate reality, calling bullshit on every unproved notion and improbable hope. Acceptance was his natural state. Running with the situation was the first rule of a good jam. His throat felt cracked and sore, and it was killing him to swallow. The fatigue was returning already, and he wished he had a comfortable place to sit and think. Could his exhaustion be a simple matter of altitude sickness? Aubrey's mind, which had a knack for generating worst-case scenarios, snatched at a new idea. He was standing on some lighter-than-air cloud of radiation. Whatever had killed the electrical power in the plane and his phone would soon wipe out the electrical impulses that governed the beating of his heart. The cloud might be producing as much atomic poison as the overheated reactors in Fukushima that had made a few dozen miles of Japan into a zone inhospitable to human life. The idea turned his kidneys into cool, stagnant water. His legs felt suddenly wobbly, and he reached thoughtlessly for something to steady himself on, and his hand fell upon the armrest of a fat easy chair. It had boiled up from the cloud behind him while he wasn't paying attention. It was a great, soft-looking throne, tinged a pretty shade of coral by the last of the day's light. He considered it with interest and suspicion, forgot all about lethal doses of radiation for a moment. He lowered himself tentatively into it. He still half expected to fall through, but, of course, he didn't. It was the soft, plump easy chair that other easy chairs dreamed of being. A coat rack, a bed, a chair, what he needed when he needed it, when he thought of it. He held this notion in his mind, turning it over, considering it. This was not a cloud. He had to stop thinking of it as a cloud. It was, what, a device, a machine? Of some kind, yes, which raised the next obvious question. What was under the hood? Where the hell was the hood? His gaze drifted uneasily to the vast central mound, the one part of the island he hadn't explored. He would have to go take a look. Not yet, though. He wasn't sure if it was strength or courage he lacked. Maybe both. He had slept at least an hour, but was still exhausted, and the sight of that huge creamy white dome oppressed him somehow. He lifted his head, searching for his next insight, and saw a cherry-colored sky scattered with the first stars. The astonishing clarity of the early night stunned him. For a moment, he felt a flicker of something dangerously like gratitude. He was not dead, and the stars were coming out in all their glittering profusion. He watched while the sky dimmed and constellations mapped the darkness. When the lid of night had fastened itself over the Midwest, he became aware that he was very cold. It was not unbearable, not yet, but it was disagreeable enough to make him turn his thoughts to the immediate problems of survival. It seemed to him important to take an inventory. He wore a jumpsuit and one Converse high top. He'd been told to leave his right shoe on the ground, but no longer remembered why. It seemed silly now. Why did you jump in only one shoe? Beneath the jumpsuit, he wore knee-length cargo shorts and a tee made out of chunky cables of knitted cotton. It was his favorite shirt because once Harriet had stroked it and said she loved the fabric. He was hungry, in a distracted sort of way. That at least could be managed for now. He remembered tucking a granola bar into his shorts earlier that morning, wanted to have something on him in case of low blood sugar. It was still there. His thirst was going to be a bigger issue. He was so thirsty his throat ached, and at the moment he didn't have any idea what he was going to do about it. Back to the inventory. He had his harness, and he had his helmet. He unzipped his jumpsuit and shivered at the wind's cold touch. He worked his hands over the pockets of his shorts, itemizing his finds. The phone, a dead slab of steel and glass. His wallet, a leather rectangle with a few cards tucked into its pockets and his student ID. He was glad for the identification. If he were blown off the cloud, or if its miraculous powers of support suddenly gave out, the smashed turnip of his body would have a name. Wouldn't that shock the shit out of some people? If his pancaked corpse turned up in northeastern Ohio or southern Pennsylvania, 100 miles away from where he'd last been seen, leaping from a plane. He took out his wallet and phone and put them on the end table. In another pocket, he jerked his head around to look at the end table. In the summer darkness, the cloud was all silver and pearl, vivid by the light of a quarter moon. After the coat rack and the bed and the chair, he was not terribly surprised to be offered an end table in response to an unarticulated wish, although it was still a jolt, the way it had snuck up on him. But what interested him most is that he knew this end table. There'd been one just like it in between the couch where his mother stretched out and the chair he usually sat in when they watched TV together, usually something like Sherlock or Downton Abbey on PBS. It was where they put the popcorn. He imagined Harriet calling his mother to say he'd been killed in a skydiving accident, then immediately pushed the thought aside, couldn't bear it. The vision of his mother screaming and collapsing into agonized sobs was more than he could take right now. No, what interested him was that this end table, which had a wide circular top and a long beaded column, was a twin of the one he remembered from childhood, the only difference being that it was made out of cloud instead of cherry. And that meant something, didn't it? His hand was still burrowed in one pocket of his cargo shorts, and his fingers fumbled at a few small waxy blocks. He plucked one out and squinted at it in the opalescent light. When he realized what it was, his body responded with a throb of pleasure and need. In the little flight office inside the airplane hangar, there'd been a glass dish on the reception desk full of individually wrapped Starburst candies. He'd furtively gone through them, picking out all the pale pink strawberry-flavored pieces. He had a weakness for them and had imagined they might come in handy. If he started panicking on the plane, he could stick one in his mouth and let sweetness infuse him. Plus, with his mouth full, he would be less likely to say cowardly, desperate things. But of course, the Starbursts had been in the pocket of his shorts, beneath the jumpsuit and harness, where he couldn't get at them, and besides, by the time they were in the sky, 3 hours later, he was so distracted by his own alarm that he'd forgotten about them. How many did he have? 3. There had been 5, but he chewed 2 to calm his nerves while he read over the pre-flight waivers. His throat ached for one, and his fingers trembled as he unwrapped it and popped it into his mouth. He shuddered with physical pleasure. It wasn't as good as a bottle of water, but it would keep his thirst in check for now, and he had 2 more for later. If his kingdom of clouds could provide him with an easy chair and an end table, couldn't it give him a pitcher of water? No, he didn't think so. If it could have, it would have already. It was responsive to his immediate needs, providing as soon as the thought occurred. So it was what? Telepathic? Well, wasn't it? How else could it know what an end table looked like? It had offered up not just any piece of furniture, but Aubrey's own platonic ideal of an end table. That had to mean it could, in some way, read his memories and beliefs like a reference guide. Life among the humans. So why couldn't it give him water? He wondered, sucking thoughtfully on the last sliver of his starburst. Wasn't cloud stuff just water in the form of a gas? Perhaps, but not this cloud stuff. When it hardened into the shape of a bed or a chair, it was not turning into snow. In Dr. Wan's waiting room, there were magazines on a coffee table. The New Yorker, Fine Cooking, Scientific American. Aubrey's thoughts flashed to a photo he'd seen in an issue of Scientific. What looked like the ghost of a brick, a semi-transparent cube of palest blue, improbably resting atop a few blades of grass. It had been something called aerogel, a block of solid matter that was lighter than air. Aubrey had an idea that the stuff beneath him now was similar in composition, but vastly superior. The last of his fruit chew melted away, leaving his mouth sticky sweet. He wanted water more than ever. He thought he should try to visualize a pitcher of water anyway, before ruling it out. God knew it would be easy enough to imagine a jug of fresh water, blocks of ice clicking off each other inside the sweating glass. But before he could so much as close his eyes and concentrate, it came to him it was already there, sitting on the end table. It had fashioned itself while his thoughts were elsewhere, a perfect pitcher made of fog, not glass, with a tumbler right beside it. He lifted the pitcher by the handle and poured. A bubbling trickle of vapor and little cubes of hardened smoke poured slowly, dreamily, into his cup. "Well, that's fucking great, thanks," he said, surprised at his own bitterness. The pitcher, ashamed, melted in his hand and drifted away. The cup puddled into fog and foamed silently off the end table, rejoining the cloud. Aubrey shivered, fumbled about at his feet, and drew a blanket of billowing fumes across his legs. better. He had lost his train of thought, tried to recall where he'd been and where he was going. An inventory. He had been making an inventory. He had completed his examination of his physical supplies. Now he turned his attention to his psychological resources, whatever they might be. He was Aubrey Langdon Griffin, single male, only child, 22 going on 23. He was an accomplished rollerblader, could speak with great fluency about MLB and the NBA, and could play the cello like a motherfucker. Aubrey had never in all his life been so struck with his own near-total lack of survival skills. In grade school, he'd had a friend, Erwin Ozick, who could make a compass with a needle and a cup of water. But right now, if Aubrey had a cup of water, he'd drink it. And besides, how the fuck was a compass going to help him? Did it matter what direction he was moving in? After all, he couldn't steer the goddamn thing. "Can I?" he wondered aloud. It had offered a bed when he was weary. It provided a coat rack when he had something that required hanging. It responded. Could he turn it back around toward Cleveland? No sooner had this notion occurred than he was pricked with another, more thrilling possibility. Could he just close his eyes and concentrate on descent? Why not just wish it down? He closed his eyes and drew a long, chilly breath, and with all his heart told the cloud. But he had not even completed mentally announcing what he wanted when he felt something push back. It was more a physical sensation than a psychological impression. His mind was filled suddenly and forcefully with the image of a smooth black mass, glassy and dense. It drove itself back into his thoughts, crushing ideas just as a boot heel might stamp a beer can flat. He recoiled in his chair, hands flying to his brow. For a moment he was blind. For a moment there was nothing but the black block. No, not a block, a pearl, filling his head. His ears popped from the pressure. An unpleasant tingle shot through his nerve endings, a rashy sensation of prickling heat. When his vision cleared, he was standing again. He didn't recall leaping to his feet. He had lost a slice of time. Not long, he believed, seconds, not minutes. The dark, thought-flattening block, the pearl, had withdrawn but had left him feeling drained and woozy. He reeled unsteadily to the bed, climbed under the thick, snowy covers. The stars wheeled against the immense crystal blackness of the night. The sky was a glassy black circle, a pearl, pressing down on him, squeezing him flat. He shut his eyes and fell and fell and fell into the bottomless darkness of the unconscious. 7. Harriet and June played the open mics on Saturday nights in a pub called the Slithy Toves. Mostly they shared a mic and played ukuleles together and looked good in sweaters and pleated skirts and cute hats. June wore a top hat, purple velvet, with a little brown taxidermied woodcock peering down from the brim. Harriet wore a shockingly loud plaid bowler. They did covers of Belle and Sebastian and Vampire Weekend, mixed in with a couple of their own tunes. Now and then June ran behind a piano and played. Aubrey saw them perform lots of times. He was in a consort that made chamber music out of video game soundtracks, and they played the Slithy Toves too. One night his group, they were called Burger Time, a joke absolutely no one got, was scheduled to go on right after Harriet and June's duo Junicorn, a joke absolutely everyone got. Harriet's last name was Cornell. He was in the dark at the edge of the stage, already had his cello out so he could rosin the bow. Junicorn was finishing their worst set ever. Harriet fucked up the opening of Oxford Comma, and the thing turned into an incoherent mess. It didn't finish so much as stagger to a halt. Then they had a little whispered fight after it became clear that Harriet had forgotten her banjo, which they needed for their cute showstopper. They played a Monty Python number, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, coaxing the audience into a sing-along. There was a good crowd, but no one was listening. Harriet had angry red blotches on her cheeks and was trying not to brush her eyes. Didn't want anyone to see how hard she was fighting not to cry. When June had finished chewing her out in a whisper that was probably audible out in the street, she sat down behind the piano, unable to look at Harriet or the crowd. They argued about what to play without making eye contact, Harriet hissing over her shoulder. A drunk in the crowd began to howl suggestions. "Play some Kiss," he shouted. "Lick it up. Hey, girls,
Let's put the X in sex. Come on.
Finally, Harriet and June agreed on Wonderwall. The noise of the crowd dipped into a brief lull, and in that moment of near silence, everyone close to the stage could hear June say, F sharp, F. F as in don't fuck it up. The people closest to the stage tittered. Harriet began to strike the chords of an acoustic guitar while June found the melody on the keys. They sang, both of them sounding fragile and heartsick, but the crowd didn't really start to listen until Aubrey began to play off stage, drawing bow across string, deepening the melody with an almost tidal sound of yearning. The girls themselves didn't notice at first, didn't realize they'd just become a trio, but they knew when they were winning the crowd back, and they straightened, their voices strengthening and twining together. The chatter fell away, and the song filled the room. The drunk wailed, I want some fucking kiss, lick it up! And then was silenced when someone else said, you're gonna be licking up whatever's on the floor, you don't shut your fucking mouth. When they sang the final chorus, their voices were brave and happy, and they knew they'd been saved, and that was when Harriet heard the cello. She turned her head and saw Aubrey in the wings. Her eyes widened and her eyebrows flew up and she looked like she wanted to laugh. When the song was over and people began to hoot, she didn't linger to enjoy the applause but bounced off the stage, took off her bowler, and put it on his head. She kissed him fiercely on the cheek. Whoever you are, I want you to know I will love you forever. Maybe longer, she said to him. June played three bars of Lick It Up, then jumped to her feet, slid across the top of the piano like a cop in an 80s action show sliding across the hood of his Ferrari, and shouted, Hey, who's in the mood for a threesome? And then she was planting a kiss on Aubrey's other cheek. She was joking, but the funny thing was, by the summer, they were one. That May, Aubrey declined a seat with the Cleveland Orchestra so he'd be free to play East Coast gigs with Junicorn. 8. He woke to a ragged cold wind and his belly cramping with hunger. A sharp stab of pain lanced him in the throat every time he swallowed. Aubrey huddled, dazed and weak, beneath the sheep fluff of his cloud blankets. They were feathery soft to the touch and held a capsule of lovely, cozy warmth. His head, though, was exposed to the elements and his ears were full of sick pain from the chill. He found his granola bar, pulled back the wrapper, and allowed himself a bite. Sticky coconut, salted almonds, a sweet caulk of chocolate. He was half frantic to gobble the rest, but he folded it back into the wrapper, returned it to his pocket, and zipped up his jumpsuit to put an extra barrier between the bar and himself. Maybe he did, after all, have a single survival skill, his restraint, which he had honed over the course of 100 nights spent in the back seat of June's car with Harriet. Sometimes Harriet dozed off with her head on his thigh, murmuring, Good night, love Muppet. Her mouth almost against his stomach. His self-control was second to none. As badly as he wanted to eat, he had wanted Harriet far more, but he never kissed her, never stroked her face, took her hand only when it was offered, except for that one time at Sugarloaf, of course, and then she had initiated the touching and the kissing, not him. He sucked on a Starburst to get some liquid into his throat. He made it last a long time while he woke up and his wits returned to him. The sky above was clouded over, a rumpled argent landscape of lead-colored hills and pewter valleys. When he cast aside his blankets and stood, the wind took a swipe at him, and his weak legs almost buckled. The gust threw his hair every which way. He staggered to the trailing aft end of the cloud. Masses of hill lay below, thickly forested. He spied the pale brown thread of a little stream. Patches of green squared off farmland. Some roads scrawled here and there. Who the fuck knew what he was looking at? Maryland? Pennsylvania? Canada? No, probably not Canada. He didn't believe he could have crossed the vast expanse of Lake Erie while he slept. It was hard to say how fast they were moving, but slower than the cars he saw gliding along the roads below. Where are you taking us? He asked. Shivering, feeling feverish. He half expected the glassy blackness, the pearl, to stamp itself into his mind again, but nothing of the sort happened. What had that been, he wondered. But he already knew it had been an answer, an emphatic no. It was refusal in the cloud's own psychic language. The castaway cast his woozy gaze around his island. He soon found himself staring again at the central mound, as big as St. Paul's Dome and shaped much the same. He drew a soft, downy robe of fog out of the smoke at his feet and a scarf, too, a 10-foot streamer of haze. He swooped a hand through the cloud and came up with a hat. When he was all bundled up, he set out for the center of the cloud, looking like a snowman brought to life. He trod across a vast, creamy meadow, through a profound hush and peace. That silence was unnerving. One didn't realize how much bustle and noise the world made until one was miles away from it, away from any other human. Aubrey had just reached the milky white dome at the heart of the cloud when a black flash filled his head, staggering him. A hand flew to his head, and he put a knee against the side of the dome. The pain, the pearl, subsided, leaving a sore space in his mind. He waited, temples throbbing, for another black psychic blast, a human bowling pin preparing to be knocked off his feet by that rolling obsidian pearl. Nothing. Aubrey thought he knew what would happen if he went on. He began to haul himself up the side of the dome. It was a steep climb, and he had to dig hands and toes into the cloud itself. It had a clammy, custardy texture to it. He might have been climbing a lump of semi-solid pudding. Aubrey climbed 2 yards and was hit by another pulverizing black crash. It was like a branch snapping into his face. His eyes watered. He stopped, went still. That obliterating mental explosion was worse than unconsciousness. It was unbeing. For an instant, Aubrey was gone. "What don't you want me to see up there?" he said. The cloud did not reply. He decided to keep climbing, just to see what would happen. How intent it was on psychically kicking the shit out of him if he persisted. He made another handhold, and another, and a dark weight dropped on his conscious mind like a falling chandelier. But when his wet, leaking eyes cleared, he found he had continued to ascend, even in those blank moments when it seemed to him he simply ceased to be. He was midway up the dome, no longer climbing but crawling on all fours as the curve became more gradual. The apex was maybe another 10 minutes of struggle away, assuming his host didn't decide to squash his mind, like a man splitting a tick between his thumb and index finger. He shut his eyes and rested, face damp from the effort of pulling himself up the slope. Aubrey felt it then, something held in the very center of the cloud, the pearl, like a marble held in one's mouth. It hummed very faintly, a low, muted drone, although Aubrey detected it right away. Maybe that was another survival skill. He had acute, sensitive ears, could hear a single off-key violin in a 50-person string section. And with that gentle thrumming noise, he sensed a kind of ache. Could one person sense the ache in another? He was seized by a disconcerting, nonsensical idea. He stood before the closed, locked door of a dark house. A family mourned within. A dead grandfather lay stiff in the sheets of his bed. Aubrey wondered if he dared knock on that door and ask for directions home. He believed that if he continued to climb, he would soon be met with another black thump. This one may be as bad as the one that had swatted him the night before when he'd asked the cloud to take him home. He turned and sat on the side of the hill and looked upon his domain, a great white fiefdom of fluffy, barren cloud. From up here, maybe 4 stories above the rest of his island, but still far from the peak of the dome, he could no longer make out his cumulonimbus bed, his chair, his coat rack. They were lost against the pale background, impossible to make out amid the other irregularities of the cloud. The castaway sat while the chill breeze cooled the sweat on his face. Perhaps a mile off, he spied a jumbo jet, a 747, climbing into the higher ceiling of cloud above. He leapt up and waved his arms, pointlessly. He was no more visible to them than his bed was visible to him. Nonetheless, he yelled and leapt. The third time he jumped, he lost his footing and went sliding back down the dome on his ass. At the bottom, he tumbled face first into the drifting paleness. His face thumped on something fluffy and soft in a way that was different from the cloud's spongy softness. He felt around for it, frowning to himself. Found it, and lifted it out of the haze. A stuffed purple horse with a silver horn and twee little wings behind its forelegs. Harriet had gone out of the plane with it, hadn't kept hold of it, and so He wasn't alone on the cloud after all. There was also the Junicorn.
9.
Junicorns were Harriet's idea, something to sell along with t-shirts and their locally produced CD, and it turned out to be an inspired business decision. Dudes bought them for their girlfriends, girls bought them for themselves, parents bought them for the kids. They sold so much horse, June said, they were practically heroin dealers. Aubrey was in the conservatory at the Cleveland Institute of Music and had arranged access to their recording studio. On their little sheet of liner notes, Harriet was credited with one song, June with two. There were a pair of covers. Everything else was Cornell Griffin Morris. Aubrey brought in the melodies and figured out the arrangements and worked out the choruses, but as far as he was concerned, Harriet's additional lyrics and June's piano fills qualified them for equal credit. He was very good at talking himself into believing these were genuinely collaborative works. In some ways, he believed it more than anyone. "Am I the only one who thinks it's stupid we're called Junicorn when Aubrey is the musical genius?" Harriet asked one day when they were recording in the spacious studio with the exposed rough wooden beams. "We ought to call the band Griffin. We could sell stuffed griffins." "Don't give him ideas," June said, and tinkled a bit of one of her songs, "I Hallucinate You," on the piano. Either that or it was Coldplay's Princess of China. All June's songs sounded like other songs. One of them sounded so much like Shadowboxer that June had once embarrassed herself by forgetting her own lyrics and singing Fiona Apple's lines when they were on stage. No one in the crowd noticed, and Harriet and Aubrey pretended not to notice either. They rolled to the gigs in June's battered old Volvo, but the boxes of Junicorns came along behind them in a dismal red Econoline driven by Ronnie Morris. The Morris brothers went to all the gigs as roadies, hauling the gear and the merch. They had learned that if you were with the band, there were frequently offers of free beer and always decent odds of meeting skanks. Along with the instruments and Junicorns and boxes of t-shirts, Ronnie and Brad almost always brought along the pen pal. The pen pal was how Aubrey thought of Harriet's boyfriend. When Harriet was 9, her father had taken her to San Diego on a business trip, which he stretched into a long weekend so they could catch a baseball game and visit the zoo. On their last morning, Harriet's dad took her down for a wander along the waterfront and bought her a soda. When her Coca-Cola was gone, Harriet tucked a note into the bottle with her address in Cleveland, a dollar bill, and a promise that there would be more money if whoever found the bottle would be her pen pal. Her father launched the sealed bottle a good 100 feet out into the sea. 2 months later, she received an envelope from someone named Chris Tybalt. He had returned her dollar bill, along with a photo of himself and an informative note. Chris was 11, and his hobby was building and launching model rockets. He had gone to Imperial Beach, just south of San Diego, to launch his new Kato rocket, and the Coca-Cola bottle had been sticking out of the sand. He let her know that his favorite president was JFK, his lucky number was 63, and he had only 4 toes on his right foot. Accident with a firecracker. The photo, standard school issue, with a cloudy blue backdrop, showed a boy with reddish-blonde hair, dimples, and braces. They wrote letters for another 3 years before they met in person, when the pen pal was on his way across country with his grandmother. Tybalt spent a weekend at Harriet's house, sleeping with his gram in the guest room. Harriet and the pen pal launched a rocket together, an Estes Astrocam that snapped a picture of them from 600 feet up, 2 pale spots in a green field, a dreamy beanstalk of pink smoke leading down to their feet. By Harriet's sophomore year in high school, they were dating, had switched to email, and agreed they loved each other. He applied to the Kent State Aeronautics program just to be near her. Aubrey thought the pen pal looked like a freckled junior investigator from a young adult novel, and never mind he was in his early 20s. He played golf with unnerving grace, looked like he'd never had acne, and had a habit of finding injured birds and nurturing them back to full health. June's brothers loved him because he was easy to get drunk, and when he was drunk, he would try to kiss them. He called them bro kisses. Aubrey desperately wanted him to turn out to be a closeted homosexual. Unfortunately, he was just Californian. When Harriet and the pen pal talked about what they would name their children, Jet if it was a boy, Kennedy if it was a girl, Aubrey felt that his own life was hopeless. There was room for Harriet in Ronnie Morris's van, but she always went to the shows with June and Aubrey in the Volvo, the pen pal insisted. Chris says, I have to, she told Aubrey on one of those rides. He says he doesn't want to be our Yoko Ono.
Ah, Aubrey said.
So we're keeping lovers apart. Riding in the back seat with me is almost a form of punishment.
Hmm,
she said, closing her eyes and rolling her head around to get comfortable in his lap. Like a weekly spanking. June cleared her throat in the front of the car in a funny way, and after a moment, Harriet made a low sound of discontent and sat up, then shifted around. Harriet had a junicorn of her own, and she made a pillow of it, dozed off with a foot of space between herself and Aubrey. 10. In the latter part of the afternoon, the wind picked up, whipping the surface of the impossible island into a series of rough wavelets. His island, like a cutter, was beating right into the blow, tacking this way and that. Aubrey smelled rain. His cloud vessel fought its way toward lowering ugly clouds, straight into a downpour like a black scarf, miles across. The first rattling pellets hit Aubrey sideways, tearing at his coat of cloud. He flinched, hugging his stuffed junicorn protectively, as a mother caught out in the rain might have protected an infant. He retreated, looking for cover. An umbrella handle of white fog protruded from a bucket of cloud next to the coat rack. He grabbed it and threw it open, and a vast, spreading canvas of hard cloud opened above him. Now and then he turned the umbrella aside to shut his eyes and open his mouth. Icy pellets of water stung his lips, tasted cold and good, tasted like licking the blade of a knife. More rain fell into a clawfoot bathtub of dense cloud. A great pool of water suspended in a chalice of ice, a deep puddle hanging in smoke. They were 3 hours in the pelting rain before his vast ship of cloud veered off to the east and raced away from the storm. Aubrey lay flat in the day's last dazzle of sunlight, head hung over the edge of the cloud to watch the mile-wide shadow of his sky island racing across the green map of the world below. By then, his belly hurt from all the water he'd drunk, using a dipper as big as his own head to collect the rain from his deep tub. By then, he had taken a nearly 30-second piss off the side of the island, a golden parabola leaping into the brilliance of the afternoon. By then, Aubrey Griffin had forgotten he was terrified of heights. It had, for the moment, slipped his mind. 11. The one time she slipped into his arms was the night they played Sugarloaf Mountain in Maine, a gig at a gastropub right off the slopes. The pen pal wasn't along that time. Harriet said he had to stay at school and study, but Aubrey learned from June that there'd been a fight. Ugly, sobbing, terrible things said, doors slammed. Harriet had come across emails from a West Coast girlfriend the pen pal had never bothered to mention. He swore they weren't still together, but he hadn't seen any reason to get rid of the photos. The half-naked selfies weren't the worst of them. The one that had really turned Harriet's stomach was a picture of Imperial Beach from 500 feet up, shot from an astrocam, the pen pal and his West Coast Sally staring up at it together. The West Coast Sally called him Rocket in her emails. Aubrey was sick at the news, sick with excitement. In 3 weeks, he was due to fly to Heathrow Airport. He was doing a semester at the Royal Academy of Music, beginning right after Christmas break. He had already put half a year of savings into the flat he was renting, money he couldn't get back, but he had a wild notion to stay, to make an insane leap, grab at a moment with Harriet. She was stiff and uncommunicative the whole 12-hour drive to the show, where they were opening for Niels Lofgren. Privately, Aubrey calculated that the pay would not quite cover the gas money, but they had free rooms in the resort, meal vouchers, and the lift tickets were on the house. In happier times, Harriet and the pen pal had made plans for a full day of skiing. In a sign of how things were now, she had not even brought her skis, muttering that she'd pulled something. Actually, it was Rocket who pulled something, wasn't it? June asked as they were loading the car. Harriet replied by slamming the trunk. Harriet spent the drive up chewing her thumbnail and glaring out at snowy rises, firs humped under powder. It had snowed heavily all the week before, and they might have been driving through a tunnel in the clouds, sculpted white cliffs rising along either side of the road. That night, they played to a room packed to the walls, people older and wealthier than they, looking for some good noise on a Saturday night after a hard day of skiing and exercising their credit cards. The room was hot and stank of hops, wet wool, wet hair, and wood smoke. Harriet wore a pair of low-slung blue jeans, and when she crouched over her acoustic, Aubrey could see the top of her emerald thong. She was especially good that evening, careless and funny, her usually clear voice pleasantly hoarsened as if she were recovering from a cold. They played and they drank, Belgian beer with a pink elephant printed on the label. Aubrey was on his fourth and feeling dizzy when he discovered that it was 8.5% ABV. There was no room in the tiny elevator for all of them and Aubrey's cello, so Aubrey and Harriet rode up together, leaving June behind with her brothers. When they got out of the third floor, Harriet looked one way, then the other, squinting at the white-numbered doors. She swayed and took Aubrey's arm. "Where's my room?" Harriet asked. "Do you remember?" Aubrey asked to see her key card, but it was just a featureless black rectangle, revealing nothing. "We'll call down from my room," Aubrey said, but they never did. 12. The stars came out, a swarm of bright sparks in the wintry dark. It felt like winter up here, 10,000 feet above the soil. Aubrey ate the last of his granola bar and huddled in his piles of blankets with the junicorn, pushing it into his face, trying to smell Harriet on it, remembering the way her hair smelled that night in Maine, like pine trees, like juniper. Thinking about Maine, remembering the way they yanked at each other's clothes, kissing almost desperately, Aubrey felt the need for Harriet as intensely as he had ever wanted water. And in the deepest part of the night, she pushed the blankets back and climbed carefully, almost shyly, to his side. A Harriet made of cloud, pillowy white breasts, cool flowing silk for hair, lips of dry fog, tongue of cool vapor. He sobbed gratefully, drew her to him, and fell into her, a long, sweet plunge without a parachute. 13. If Aubrey woke up first, he believed his whole life might have been different. He didn't know what that would have been like, to awake bathed in sunlight amid the pillows and piles of white sheets, with Harriet naked beside him. How he would have liked to see the light on her bare back. How he wished to wake her with a kiss on her shoulder. But when he clawed his way up out of sleep, Harriet had already left. She didn't answer the knock on her hotel room door. She wasn't at the breakfast buffet. He did not see her all the rest of the time they were at Sugarloaf, except once, briefly. She was in the courtyard in front of the resort, shivering in a too flimsy denim jacket, eyes streaming while she had it out with someone on the phone. The boyfriend, he was sure, and he felt a great throb of hope. "They are breaking up," he thought. "She is breaking up with him, and now it will be our time." He was watching through the tinted front windows of the hotel lobby, and he would have gone to her, wanted to be close to her if she needed him, if his silent presence would help her get through it. But he'd arrived in the lobby with June, who was in a lot of pain. She was having nasty cramps, she said, or maybe a reaction to something she'd eaten. She was hanging onto Aubrey's arm, and after they had both looked out on the scene in the courtyard for a moment, she tugged him toward the reception desk. "Let her be," June said. "I need you more than she does. I'm bleeding so bad it's less like menstruation, more like afterbirth. I could not have more stuff spilling out of me without giving it a name and buying it diapers." June was in such a bad way that she asked Aubrey to do the driving. By the time Aubrey got his cello downstairs, Harriet was already gone. She had split with the Morris brothers. June said it was because Harriet had an obliterating headache and wanted to sleep on the bed in the back of the van. But Aubrey was disturbed. It felt less as if Harriet had departed, more like she'd fled. "I think that pink elephant stuff we drank last night might be aggravating my period," June said. "Sure isn't helping. We all drank way too much. I wish I could have last night back. I bet Harriet does, too. Like Reagan said, mistakes were made." Aubrey wanted to ask what she meant by that, wanted to know what June knew, if she was talking about more than beer. But he lacked the courage, and soon June was asleep and snoring in a very unlovely way. When he was back in his apartment, he texted Harriet almost a dozen times, beginning with, "Wow, so that happened. continuing on to, I really want to give this a chance, and finishing with, are you there? Are you okay? She didn't reply, and her silence made him sick with dread. He couldn't sleep, couldn't even get into bed. He paced his little bedroom, his stomach upset, playing games on his phone so he wouldn't have to think. Finally, he dozed off on his threadbare second-hand couch, which smelled faintly of rancid pizza. His phone finally plinked with a message at 4:15 in the morning. I'm a horrible person. I'm so sorry. I shouldn't have done that. It wasn't fair to you. I need to be alone for a while. I've had a boy in my life since I was 9, and now I need to figure out who I am without one. Please don't hate me. Please never hate me, my friend Aubrey. Beneath that was an emoji of a heart being torn in two. 3 weeks later, he was putting his bags down in a flat in the East End. He didn't hear from Harriet again until March, and then it was another text. June is really, really sick. Can you call? 14. He thought his cloud Harriet would be gone when he woke, but she was cuddled against his chest, the gossamer specter of a girl with the blind, smooth features of classical statuary. Her hair streamed and curled in the breeze, feathers of white silk. His cock was chapped from screwing her. It had been a little like fucking a pail filled with cold porridge. He didn't tell her that, though. Aubrey liked to think he was a gentleman. Instead, he said, "You're a good kisser." She gazed at him adoringly. "Do you understand me?" She knelt on the bed, hands on her thighs, studying him with a rapt and vaguely idiotic devotion. He took her hands of smoke and squeezed, squishing them a tiny bit out of shape. "I have to get down to the ground. I'll starve up here." Her hands spilled out of his as effortlessly as water dribbling through his fingers. She seemed, briefly, diminished and disheartened. Her slumped shoulders implied he was a buzzkill. "You must care about me," he tried again, "or you'd let me fall, but you have to understand I'll die if I stay up here. From exposure or hunger." Cloud Harriet gazed at him with a blind look of desperate concern, then spun away, dropped her slender legs over the side of the bed. She cast a sly, beckoning glance over her shoulder and nodded out across the cloud to point his attention to what waited there. A palace of cloud, like something from the Arabian Nights, loomed beyond. A soaring mass of minarets and arches, courtyards and walls, staircases and ramps. The magnificent structure swelled high into the sky, dazzling in the early morning light, as opalescent as a pearl. The pearl! It had sprung up overnight and crowded around the towering dome at the center of his floating island. He rose to follow her, and staggered and nearly went to one knee. He was weak, felt as light as a cloud himself. He was a long way from starvation. That would take weeks, but his hunger left him dazed, and when he moved too quickly, his head swam. She took his hand, and soon they came to a moat. His heart lunged. A ring of open sky encircled the castle. He could see folds of green earth a couple miles below, ravines and shadowed fur-covered slopes. She tugged his arm and led him across a wide drawbridge of smoke and through the palace gates. When they were on the other side, he pulled his hand free and turned in a slow circle, taking it all in. They had entered a grand hall with lofty arched ceilings the color of snow. It was like standing beneath a giant's wedding dress. He got so dizzy turning around and around that he almost fell again. Harriet caught his elbow and steadied him, then guided him to an immense white throne. He sat, grateful to be off his wobbly legs, and she sank into his lap, all cool slender waist and round hips. He shut his eyes and rested his head on her chill, comforting shoulder. It was a relief, anyway, to be held. But when he opened his eyes, he discovered he was holding a cello of cloud. Her smooth, perfect ass, slender waist, and pale bosom had become the body of the instrument. His Harriet of the troposphere now sat a yard away, in a silky pale gown, watching him with the adoration of a dog regarding a man holding a hamburger. Aubrey reached into the cloud at his feet and drew a bow, whip thin and the translucent white of a fishbone. He was hungry, and from the first stroke played the music of hunger. Mahler, Symphony No. 5, the third part, a meditation on doing without, on realizing what wasn't and couldn't be. A cloud cello did not sound like a wooden cello. It had the low, haunting sound of the wind beneath the eaves, of a gale blowing across the spout of an empty jug. But for all that, the song was distinct. Sky Harriet rose from her stool and swayed and turned. He thought of a sea frond pulled by the tide, and when he swallowed, his throat clicked. She revolved like a ballerina in a music box, a stem of a girl, with a complexion of unearthly smoothness. It was as if he spun her himself, as if she were a lathe powered by song. She lifted from the cloud beneath her feet and rose on spreading wings of hallucinatory beauty and began to sail in circles above him. He was so entranced, he forgot to play. It didn't matter. The cello played on without him, standing before his knees while the bow floated there, stroking strings he'd been able to feel but not quite see. The sight of her drew Aubrey to his feet. He reeled, reaching for her. He wanted to be held, to fly. She dipped, caught his hand, pulled him into the great heights beneath the palace roof. He left his stomach behind. Air whistled, and the cello yearned, and he cried out and seized her to him, her hips to his. They fell, swooped, rose again, his blood heavy and his head light. He was already hard. His Harriet of the Mists carried him to a landing at the top of a dizzying staircase. They collapsed there together. Wings became honeymoon sheets, and he took her again, while the cello played a lewd, strutting cabaret number below. 15. June got better, June got worse. It was one good month when she was getting around on aluminum crutches, her head wrapped in a scarf, and she was talking about adjusting to her new reality. Then she stopped talking about adjusting and took a bed in the cancer ward. Aubrey brought her a ukulele, but it never moved from its spot between the spider plants on her windowsill. One day when Aubrey and June were alone together, Harriet and June's brothers had gone down to the gift shop to get candy bars. June said, "When we're all done here, I want you to move on as quickly as possible." "Why don't you let me worry about how to deal with my feelings?" Aubrey said. "This may come as a surprise to you, but I can't just be done with you without a thought, like you're an umbrella I left at a hotel." "I'm not talking about me, dummy," June said. "I expect you to grieve for me for at least a decade. I want a prolonged period of grim desolation and at least a little unmanly crying in public." "So what are you—" "Her. Harriet. It's not happening, dude. You played in our shitty band for almost 2 years hoping to tap that. It already happened." June looked away, past her dusty ukulele, out the window at the parking lot. Rain pricked at the glass. "Oh, that." June sighed. "I wouldn't make too much of that, Aubrey. She was having a really bad week, and you were safe." "Why was I safe?" June looked at him blankly, as if the answer were glaringly obvious. "And maybe it was. You were going away for 6 months. You don't start a relationship with someone who has his suitcases packed and 1 foot out the door. You were safe, and she knew there was nothing she could ever do that would make you hate her." Ever since June was first diagnosed with lymphoma, she'd been parceling out nuggets of gentle wisdom, pretending she was Judy Dench or Whoopi Goldberg playing the tragic mentor in a heart-affirming movie about what really matters in life. It wore on him. "Maybe you should try to sleep," he said. "I was pissed off at her, you know," June told him, as if he hadn't spoken. "Because we got drunk and fooled around?" "No, not because of that, because of everything before that. All those nights she put her head in your lap on long, dark rides, introducing you to people as her love muppet. You can't do things like that to people. They might fall in love with you." "Okay," he said, in a tone that meant it wasn't. "No, it's not," she said. "It was very unfair to you. I've had some of the best and most important conversations of my life with Harriet." "Of your life, not hers. You wrote that song about wearing each other's favorite sweaters, and she sang it, but Aubrey, those were your lyrics, not hers. She was just singing the words you wrote for her. You need to break up." "We're not together." "You are in your head. You need to break up with imaginary Harriet and fall in love with someone who will love you back. Not that real Harriet doesn't love you, she just doesn't love you like that." "Where the fuck is the real Harriet?" he fumed. "I think she walked all the way to Hershey, Pennsylvania to get this candy bar." She was always going off on these quests with June's brothers, determined to find June the weird chocolate or weird soda or weird t-shirt that would make another day with cancer less depressing. June sighed in a very heavy sort of way and turned her head to look out the window. Why are there so many romantic songs about the spring? I hate the spring. The snow melts, and everything smells like thawing dog shit. Don't you dare write any romantic songs about springtime, Aubrey. It would kill me, and dying once is bad enough. 16. For a long time afterward, he lay panting, happily exhausted and slicked with cool sweat. His head was spinny from the combination of hunger and exertion, but the sensation was not entirely disagreeable. Came with the endorphin rush that might accompany a whirl on a fairground ride. She had slipped away, melted in his hands when his orgasm was complete, flowed across the floor in a shuddering blanket of fog. He liked to think it had been good for her, too. When he looked about for her, he saw her waiting through a high archway at a ghost-colored table. He wriggled back into his jumpsuit and walked into a grand dining room. He looked upon the immensity of the table, set with spectral goblets, a cottony-looking white turkey, and a bowl of cloud fruit. Aubrey was famished. More than famished, almost shaky with hunger, but the sight of the smoke food wasn't promising. He couldn't smell it. It was sculpture, not dinner. She carved him a slice of nothing, put it on a platter of sky, next to a prickly-looking cloud fruit. She regarded him with an almost childlike desire to please. "Thanks," he said. "Looks delicious." He used a pale knife to cut a long canoe-shaped slice of the cloud fruit. Aubrey speared it with his fork, considered it in the muted light, then decided what the fuck and took a bite. It crunched and splintered, not unlike rock candy. It tasted of rain, coppery and cold. He had been in error. Close up, it did have a scent. It smelled faintly like thunder showers. He tucked in. 17. It started to hurt on his second slice of phantom turkey breast, a sharp lancing strike of pain through his abdomen. He grunted, clenching his teeth together, and bent over in his smoky chair. His mouth had a silky residue in it, a bad flavor like he'd been sucking on a handful of grimy pocket change. Another sewing needle pushed itself through his intestines. He cried out. Sky Harriet, sitting catty-corner to him, reached for Aubrey in alarm, taking his hand in hers. With her free hand, she passed him a goblet of white smoke. He drank the froth in desperation, two big swallows, before he realized it was just more of God-knew-what toxic foam. He flung the goblet away. Bumblebees crawled frantically through his insides, stinging haphazardly. He lurched to his feet, accidentally tearing Sky Harriet's hand off. She didn't seem to mind. He hurried through the archway as he was stricken with another shooting burst of pain. His bowels cramped. Oh, God. Aubrey went down the stairs in a kind of controlled fall, a fast, reckless stumble, not at all sure where he was going. It felt as if his intestines were wrapped in a throttling coil of steel wire, drawing ever tighter with each passing moment. He had never before felt so desperately close to filling his pants. It was like losing an arm wrestling match, only with his sphincter. He flung himself through the gates and raced across the bridge spanning the moat. A toilet abided beside his Cadillac-sized bed. He ran the last 5 steps with his jumpsuit around his knees, shackling his legs. He sat. There was an eruption. He groaned. It felt like he was passing a lump of glass splinters. His gut squeezed again, and he felt the shock of pain down into his knees. His feet tingled, the circulation draining out of them. The third time his bowels convulsed, he felt a stab of pain behind his breastbone. An intense wavering shock radiated through his chest. His high-altitude Harriet watched from a few yards away, her Greek goddess features set in an expression of transcendent mourning. "Excuse me, please," he cried, straining at a fresh mass of stainless steel slivers. What he really wanted to scream was, "Get the fuck away from me, or maybe you just killed me, bitch!" But he didn't have the courage for cruelty. It wasn't in his nature. "I need to be alone. I'm sick." She dissolved into gossamer streamers, a silken waterfall that was absorbed into the cloud at her feet. 18. What a thing to ask of her. I need to be alone. There was no alone. For that matter, there was no her. There was only the cloud. He knew from the first moment he looked into her face she wasn't looking back at him. Not with her eyes, anyway.